Firstly, thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for inviting me to talk about this particular topic. It's one that is very close to my heart, but in ways that one might not expect. So one thing that I want to emphasize at the outset, that this is not a shiur about leaning. I think that Bali Kriya will have something of an advantage in appreciating some of the things we're going to talk about, simply for the reason that there's a very big difference, I would say intellectually, when you come to a subject where you have all the data at your fingertips or a lot of it, and someone is simply trying to place order to the data that you already know in your head, as opposed to where you're approaching something where you've never been exposed to the data before, and now you're being told a series of rules, and then you'll be shown some of the data. So I think Bali Kriya certainly will have a more instinctual appreciation for some of the material that we're doing, but it's really not about leaning itself. But it's about, if I had to describe it in one word, one phrase, it's about the impact of Ta'ameha Mikra on interpretation, on biblical interpretation. I'll also state, I don't, of course, steer anybody away, that the opening shiur will probably be the easiest shiur. It'll be the one that's most accessible. The subsequent shiur will be more challenging, I think very much worthwhile. And I would warn the Bali Kriya, unless they have really encountered this material before, it will help being a Bal Kore, but it will be something that I think is fundamentally new. So let me begin just by talking about the term Ta'ameha Mikra, and I'm normally going to refer to it by the, I guess it's, I assume it's a Yiddish term, the trup, the symbols that we typically associate with the music. The word tam has at least three different meanings. The one that usually comes to mind for most of us is the word ta'am means reason. This is a common usage in rabbinic Hebrew. It is not one that I think can be associated with the term ta'ameh ha-mikra. There are two other usages. One, which is very common in the Rishonim, in Ibn Ezra and Radak, and when you and I know, at least from my experience, when I was first learning them, I couldn't understand. They kept using the word tam, but it didn't mean reason. What tam meant was the interpretation. Ibn Ezra will often give you grammatical analysis of a term, of a phrase, and then he'll say v'ta'amo, and its explanation is now what the phrase actually means. And that actually might be one possible way of understanding ta'ameh hamikra. Ta'ameh hamikra provide an interpretation, a way to interpret any particular verse. And I think it's worth noting that just when we talk about a targum, a translation, either the classic Aramaic targum or any translation, every translation by definition is interpretation. Now, we tend to think of translations as being very literal, and some translations tend to be very literal, but nonetheless, when you go from translating a text into any language, including its own language, let's say updating a dialect. If you were to translate the Tanakh into modern Hebrew, I've never seen such a thing. I'm sure it must exist. It involves interpretation. There's no such thing as a translation which isn't interpretation. And the translation that the translator presents you with reflects the way he or she has read the text. The same thing can be said about Ta'ameh HaMikra, which is whoever is responsible, and we'll talk about that a little bit, for our Ta'amim, for our trap, it reflects either their own interpretation or their interpretation, the tradition of interpretation that they are now imposing on the text itself. There is a third possible meaning for the word ta'am, I think. I'm not sure I can prove this, but the ta'am can also refer to the accent. Very much in this particular context, the Rishonim will often, and it's hard to tease it out, but we'll look at the soon, relatively soon, a few couple of Rashis where Rashi will say ta'amo lamala or ta'amo lamata. It'll tell you where the accent is. But since the trup, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, is also generally used to tell you where the accent is, so I don't know if you can sort of separate those two. But let me use that as the segue to talking about three functions of Ta'ameh HaMikra, three functions of trup. The first function, which I'm not going to really discuss or explore very much, is to provide music for the text. Why do we have music for a text? So probably the primary reason we do so is based upon a Gemara at the end of Megillah, the last Amud, Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph, that kol ha-korei b'lo ne'ima v'hashona b'lo zimra. So all of HaKasav Omer, all these bad things. A person who reads without singing, and who studies without a tune. So basically it means that you don't really appreciate what God has given you. Now, that is sort of a homiletic comment. One of the reasons, I think we read with a sing song in the Beis Medrash, or where you read the Tanakh with Trup, is because it aids in memory. And those who are Bali Kriya know when you're trying to sort of pull a verse out of your head, if you have a piece of it, once you have the beginning, you can sort of naturally flow into the next part. But I think it's really an aid in memory. So I'm not going to talk about the music itself. I mean, there are a few things that I'll lane at some point, but it's really not the focus that we're going to have. The different Eidot, the different communities of Klal Yisrael have different music. The Eastern European musical tradition is one. The Yekas have a different musical tradition. The Sephardim have a different musical tradition. I've never heard Yemenite laning. I assume the Yemenites probably have their own laning. And I'm sure within each of these communities, there are different traditions or different musical ways of implementing the laning. Even within the tradition that I know well, the Eastern European tradition, we have actually six different kinds of trup. We have trup for regular Torah reading. We have trup for the Haftorah. We have trup for the Shalosh Regalim Megillos, for Shir HaShir and for Koheles and for Rus. We have a trup for Megillas Esther. We have a similar but slightly different trup from Esther for Megillas Eicha. And we have the trup that is typically used on Yomim Noran, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Some people use it for shtick purposes on Simchas Torah. So we really have a whole different set of musical, I don't know what you want to call it, we'll call it traditions, even within the Eastern European tradition. And that's not counting something that I'll talk about in a few weeks, God willing, which is a trup for the three books we call the Sifrei Emes, Iyov, Mishlei, and Tehillim, which actually have different trup than the other 21 books of Tanakh. And as the other 21 books of Tanakh have the same trup with the same rules of how they're used, but we lay in some of them in different ways. But the three books, Iyov, Mishlei, and Tehillim, which are primarily poetry in their construction, have a different set of trup. At first glance, they might look a little familiar, but many of them are very, very different in how they're used. So I'm not really going to explore the musical tradition, but that's obviously the one. If you step into a shul and you hear and you hear the Torah read, the thing that's going to jump out at you and you're going to assume is going to be based upon the trup is going to be the music of the person reading the Torah. The second, which I'm going to talk about just a little bit now, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, is the issue of pronunciation, specifically where the accent on a word goes. I don't know. I'm sure there's some people in the audience who share this particular feeling. To me, there's nothing that's more painful than to hear the Torah read with the wrong accents. You know, when sometimes when they call someone for Haftorah and they perform an act of ritual slaughtering on it. So my friends love, I usually sit, I think, pretty much the front row, they can see. They want to see the pained expression on my face, because even if I try to suppress it, I tell my students that, you know, I could be dead lying in the coffin. And if at my hesped you mispronounce the accent on the pasuk you quote, I'll probably open the lid and correct you. So Trump plays a role in telling you where the accent goes. And this is crucial in many cases. I won't say most cases, but in many cases, shifting an accent on a word can change the meaning. I'm not going to explore this. I'm going to give a couple of examples. And even before I give them out, I'll give you one. I would say in general, this topic is somewhat relevant for davening as well. We don't have ta'amim on davening. But we would do well, actually, to have ta'amim for two of the three functions that ta'amim play for scripture. We could use them in davening as well. The accents for words, and the other, which is the last part, which is really our focus, is punctuation. The commas, the sentence divisions, and bigger units, smaller units, and so on. So that's really going to be our main focus. But just for a few minutes about accents, one in particular davening, which really is a significant one. It's significant because it turns what is a statement about God's greatness into a statement of blasphemy. In the bracha of modim of hoda'ah, so we say hatov ki lo chalu rachamecha v'hamarachem ki lo samu chasadecha. The expression hatov ki lo chalu rachamecha means that God is good and his mercy never ceases. The root of kalu is kaf lamed yud, and words like that almost always have the accent on the last syllable. So the word is kalu, not kalu. And that phrase is actually based upon a pasuk in Eicha, where Yirmiyahu Navi says, ki lo chalu rachamav, describing God, his mercy never ceases. If you read the word chalu with the accent, what we call mile'el, there are two kinds of Hebrew accents. I should say there are only two places on a Hebrew word in Tanakh where an accent can be. The last syllable, which is called milera, milera means in Aramaic below, mitachas, or mile'el, which means above, the second to last syllable. There is no accent in Hebrew on any syllable but the last or the second to last syllable. And if you think you see such a thing, there are rare examples, you're not seeing correctly. So if you read the word chalu, it's a completely different word. It comes from the root chaf vav lamed, which means God's mercy is insufficient. It can't contain what is needed. In which case, you're basically saying God's mercy, God doesn't have enough mercy. He's not capable. That's basically blasphemy. One of the reasons why people mispronounce it is because the next word, atov kilo chalu rahavachem kilo samu chasadecha, that accent attracts the first accent to read it as kilo chalu. But you should be very careful when you daven for the amid and privately that you say hatov kilo chalu rachamecha. So that's, there are probably other examples in davening, but that's the one that always sort of comes to mind as the classic example where if you miss the accent, you've not just mispronounced the word, but you've done some very bad things. Okay. Now I'm going to talk about a few examples about accents in a moment, but I just want to, again, not lose focus. The third function of trup is to provide punctuation in the sentence. And that is obviously, even more so than accent, that's absolutely crucial for meaning, because shifting a comma can have huge implications. I suspect there's a book called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, which perfectly encapsulates that idea, that where you put the commas will completely change the meaning of the sentence. So that's really what we're going to focus on, but just a couple of examples of accents. Now, if you take a look at the source sheet, and the first one is very, very famous. I think if there's one example of a shift in accent that changes the meaning, and both are actually have valid meanings, it's a Rashi in Parshas Vayetze. This is not the only place where Rashi talks about this kind of a word, but I've chosen this as the example. So Yaakov comes to Haran, and he meets the shepherds, and he asks them if they know Lavan ben Nachar, and they say Yadanu. And then he asks them, and this is the first pasuk vav, Vayomer lohem hashalom lo. Is he well? Vayomru shalom. Yeah, he's in peace. V'hinei Rachel bito ba'o im hatzon. So the axe, the trup on the word ba'a, which is the only trup I placed here, is under the aleph. Now Rashi notes that when the root, beis vav aleph, means to come. But if you say about a woman, ba'a, it means she is coming. It's present tense. If you say ba'a, mil'el, on the first syllable, on the second to last syllable, it means she came or has come. It's already past tense. Now, later, a few psukim later, when Rachel finally shows up, it says, Odenu midaber imam, v'rachel ba'a, the trup there is on the base, imhatzon asher le'avi akira ahi. So at that point, she had come. The shepherds told Yaakov, she's coming. And then the narration, the Torah narrates to us, at that point, she had come already. Rashi writes, source number two, ba'a im hatzon, hata'am ba'alef, either the accent or the trup, which in this case will be in effect the same, is on the aleph. Vitargumo in the Aramaic translation is osiya, which is the present tense in Aramaic. V'rachel ba'a hata'am lamala, the accent is mila'el, it's on the second to last syllable. Bebeis, vitargumo asas, which means she came. Harishon Lishon Osa, the first one means, is present tense, she is doing, she is coming. V'hasheni Lishon Osusa. So this happens to be characteristic of pretty much all what we call ayin va verbs, the other very common one, and there are some confusing problems in Parshas Vayigash about this, is the word shava. Shava means she returned. Shava means she is returning. So that's one example. The second example, which is a favorite example of mine, is special for two reasons. Number one is that both meanings are actually plausible, or certainly seem to be plausible. Number two, it's particularly interesting for me because I don't know what it is or what it reflects about my personality, but I can remember almost every mistake I've made in Kriyas HaTorah. It's not because I've only made three mistakes over the course of the years, or I should say things that I learned wrong in the first place and only learned later. I have a lot of memories of those things, and they're not a few. They're a good number of them. And this happens to be one that the first 2 years I was reading Kriyas HaTorah, you know, as a teenager, nobody corrected me. And I only realized later, and I realized the difference in meaning. So speaking about, in Parshas Vayishlach, about the brothers plundering Shechem after Shimon and Levi killed everybody, it says, Ves kol chelam, ves kol tapon, ves nesheihem, all their money and their children and their wives, shavu vayavozu. Now, what does the word shavu mean? So if you're not initiated so much, you would think it means, oh, they made multiple trips. They came back and they plundered. They had taken some stuff. They took first they took Dina out, and now the brothers, they come back and they take out the rest of the stuff. The Eis Kol HaShavavais, everything in their houses. But that's not what the word shavu means. The word shavu, with the accent where it is, means to take captive, shin beis yud. It's very much connected to the word biza, vayavozu. Those two words are connected. So it means that their plunder, maybe it's their animals and their children and their wives, they took captive and they plundered and everything that was in the house. Now, Rashi writes here, shavu lishon shivia. Lefikach, Tamo Milara. I don't know if that's really originally part of Rashi, but Rashi tells you that the accent is on the last syllable. That teaches you that it's Shin Beis Yud, like Chalu is Kaf Lamed Yud. If the accent had been Mila'el on the Shin, so then it would have been Shavu Vayavozu, they returned and they took captive, which is not impossible. You know, it could have made sense in the Pasuk, but that's not the more likely reading, and that's not where the Baalei Masorah placed the, well, it's not, I didn't explain with Bala Masara, more on that in a little bit. That's where the accent, the trup, was placed to tell you how to read the word. Now, a word of caution, if you're an uninitiated as a Balkriya, and you're using the word, you're using the trup to figure out how you pronounce the word, it is generally speaking a good rule that wherever the trup is where the accent is. Except there are a number of exceptions. There are a number of exceptions. One of them, for example, if you turn to the last sheet, and here once again, I will speak of my personal, this is truly mortifying. I was taught from my bar mitzvah, but I'm not going to say who taught me because there's certain things that he didn't teach me. One of them was, he didn't teach me that if you look at the fifth trap, Kadma Munach Zarka Munach Segol, it's true for the Zarka and the Segol, that the trup is always placed right after the last letter. It doesn't tell you where the accent is. So I know my bar mitzvah parsha, in Parsha's Truma, the first year, and then the second year, I lay in the next year, and then a friend's father came over and gently pointed this out to me. I read that shlosha givim mishukadim bakone achad kaftar v'ferach, shlosha givim mishukadim bakone achad kaftar v'ferach. Now, that accent would almost kill me now to think that I would have read something that way. But I had been told that the Zarka, and if you're looking at the trap now, the Segol, further on the line, the Pashta, and then the Tlisha Kitana, Tlisha Gedola on the next line. Is there one more? I don't remember. Is there one more? Maybe that's it for now. The Yisiv. The Yisiv on the last line there that I've added in. Those trup are not placed where the accent is. Most of them, four of them, are always placed after the last letter. The Tlisha Gedola and the Yisiv are normally placed before the first letter of a word. Now you'll ask me, how do you know where the accent goes in those cases? The answer is you have to know the Hebrew language. Most of the time, knowing the Hebrew language, The better way, that's not fair. What I should say is, if you can find that word elsewhere in Tanakh with a regular trop, not one of these six trop, you'll find out where the accent actually goes. If you cannot find it in another place, so ask your local Baal Kriya, if he's pretty good, he'll probably know the answer to the question. Only one of those trop, by the way. Well, I won't talk about that more now. I'm going to leave that for now. More about that when we talk about next week, when we go through the trop one by one, I'll point out some of the individual details. But I will spill you one very juicy tidbit, which is, does anybody know why the Tlisha and the Gedola and the Tlisha Katana are placed the way they are? Why is the Tlisha Gedola placed after the word and Tlisha Katana before the word? I won't ask. The answer is, if you go back to the, what's that?
It's the other way around.
I'm sorry, Tlisha Gedola before the word, Tlisha Katana after the word. Why are they placed in that way? And the answer is, because in the earliest versions of the trop, when they were this written symbols, the symbol for the Tlisha Gedola, Tlisha Katana were identical. They were just a circle with no leg. And the only way the Bali Masora, whom I will explain in a moment who they are, could distinguish between the two was to put one before the word and one after the word. Okay. So trop plays a crucial role in terms of determining where you place the accent, and not always, but a lot of the time that can have an impact upon meaning. Okay. So now I want to really turn to the primary function before, which is punctuation. Before we do that, I want to give you just a brief history as to the trop. Where does it come from? Now, the Gemara in source number 5, speaking about a pasuk in Ezra Nehemiah, where they had a public Torah reading. So the Gemara says, you can already go to the second line. Vayikru b'sefer Torah ha'elokim. And this, by the way, there is no such pasuk. It's actually vayikru b'sefer b'toras ha'elokim. Don't ask why this happened in every printing of the Gemara. Zemikra. That's actually reading the pasuk. Miforash is the next word. Zetargum. That's the explanation. Visom sechel, which means to pay attention, to put one's mind to it. Eile, elu hapsukim. They are the verse breaks. And vayavinu bamikra, they understood, or they penetrated, had a penetrating understanding of scripture. Ze pisuk ta'amim. This is what we would call the trup, but a very specific notion, pisuk, which refers to punctuation. V'amri la elu hamasoros. I'm not going to talk about what the masoros are right now, what the alternative version is. But what does this mean, elu hapsukim? So if you look in source 6, the Ran says, nikudos hamafsikos bein pasuk lepasuk. Now, it's very, very interesting that if you look at the earliest Tanakhs, you will see that there are actually two markers to an end of a pasuk. The one of them is actually a trop. Many of you who know this call it a self pasuk. The term that's actually used is a siluk. The siluk is the little dash, the little line, you know, vertical line underneath the last word in the pasuk. There are also, and I'm pretty sure you will see this in the early Tanakh, a colon between verses. That colon is not trop. It's just a verse division. It plays a role, but it's not technically necessary. So the Ran sounds like, when he says Elu HaPsukim, it's the two dots that separate verses, what we would call a colon. But in the early Tanakhs, it's used actually as the verse separator. And then you have these Pisuk Ta'amim. So what exactly is the Pisuk Ta'amim? So the Ran then continues and says, he says something here, but this is really more relevant for the trop. He says, V'kari lahu som sechel, which is the, it calls this understanding or paying attention, shal yedehim adam mevin hamikra kifi tnuas ha-ta'amim. Based upon these, a person can understand the flow of the trop, the motion of the trop, ki da'amar b'perakama d'chagiga nafkal mina lipsuke tame. Now that really, and we're going to look at the Gemara Chagiga and spend a little time on this because it's a fascinating, fascinating example. The Gemara Chagiga says, the Gemara Chagiga has a question of biblical interpretation. What does a verse mean? And the Gemara says, okay, well, what's the difference? Because it's about something that happened at Maamad Har Sinai, about Karbanos, the sacrifices that were brought. What was, was. It's not happening anymore. Who cares? So the Gemara there says, Nafgamina lepsuke taime. No, the relevance is when you read scripture, what kind of trup do you put on there? What kind of punctuation or commas do you place? So now let's take a look at that Gemara in Chagiga. Now, first, let's just read the verse. It's on the bottom of the first source sheet. It says, Vayishlachas na'arei b'nei Yisrael. This is at the end of Parshas Mishpatim, probably before Matan Torah. Vayishlachas na'arei b'nei Yisrael vayalu olos, vayizbechu zvachim shlamim la'shem parim. Now, if I were just translating this verse, I would say, and he sent, Moses sent, the young people, let's say the firstborns of the Jewish people, and they brought Ola sacrifices, and they slaughtered Shlamim sacrifices to God, oxen. Now, the Gemara wants to know the following. Take a look at source 7 now. Bo'i Rav Chista, Haikra Hechiksiv. How is one to understand this pasuk? Vayishlach es na'arei b'nei Yisrael vayalu olos. That would be kavasim. That might be the standard Ola. They brought sheep. And then vayizbechu zvachim shlamim lashem parim. So would you understand that there are really two sentences here? First, vayalu olos. They brought olos. It doesn't say what they brought, but probably they could have been sheep. And then they brought shlamim sacrifices, and they brought oxen for them. So that's one way of reading it. Odilma idi v'idim parim havo. Do you say that the word oxen at the end of the verse modifies both parts? Vayalu olos, number one, and vayizbechu zvachim shlamim lashem parim. The olos were oxen, and the shlamim were oxen. And the Gemara says, l'may nafgamina, what difference does it make? Mar zutra amar, l'pisuk ta'amim. How you want to place the trap. Now, I'm going to look at, I presented the pasuk here in two different ways. The first way is the way the trap actually read. The second way is the alternative interpretation. And Reb Breuer actually, I should stop for one moment just to give a lot of credit. Most of what I know about Tame HaMikra's punctuation, it's a beyond the very basics. Beyond the very basics comes from Reb Mordechai Breuer, who was obviously a giant in Tanakh study. And he has a sefer called Tame HaMikra. This is not a work, I would say, for the faint-hearted. It is a challenging book to read. If you're a Baal Kriya, it's much easier, although it is still quite challenging. But so much of what I've learned about the finer details of punctuation really come from Reb Breuer. So in this particular case, he has a piece in his last chapter about interpretation where he goes through more than one possibility. But I'm just presenting here, I think, the two most straightforward possibilities in the Gemara. One, the first is what we have in our trup, and the second is what the alternative would have been. So if you look at the first presentation, and this is the way it works, and I'll read it with the music. So here we can a musical accompaniment, because the music doesn't always, but very often does convey to some extent the sense of punctuation. So it goes like this. Vayishlach es na'arei b'nei Yisrael vayalu olos. Now that's the esnachta, and most people, many of you are aware, that's the major pause dividing a pasuk into two. And then vayizbechu zivachim shelamim ladonoi parim. Now, if you read it that way, and that is the first way the Gemara presents it, it's Moshe sent the Bechorim, and they brought Olos. Now, it doesn't say what animals they used, but that is the major pause. And the second half of the sentence says, Vayizbechu zvachim shlamim lashem parim. In the second half of the verse, the biggest pause, and this is what we're going to work on next week, is after the word lahashem. It means they brought shlamim sacrifices to God, comma, parim. There's a smaller pause after the word shlamim. But if you read it this way, which is the way our Sifrei Tanakh read, it's the first interpretation offered in the Gemara, which is that the olos were not necessarily oxen. There's a second way, and this is not the only way that one could have placed the trap, although if you believe the word parim, modifies both olos, both the olah sacrifices and the shlama sacrifices, this is probably the best way. Vayishlach es na'arei b'nei Yisrael, vayalu olos, vayizbechu zivachim shilamim, ladonoi parim. Now, when you break it down this way, when I look at the second half of the verse, the first biggest division in the verse is after the word Lahashem. So the two halves of the second part of the verse are Vayalu olos vayizbechu zivachim shlamim Lahashem, parim. So it's clear parim modifies both. The next step is going to be the following. Within the previous clause, the biggest pause is after the word shlamim. So it's Vayalu olos vayizbechu zivachim shlamim Lahashem. Lahashem goes on both of them. Both of them were sacrifices for God, and then they were parim. And then within the first five words, Vayalu olos vayizbechu zivachim shlamim, there was one pause on the word olos. When I say those pauses, in this case, it's not just the meaning. Here, the trup conforms to the meaning. Now, I should not forget to mention, trup doesn't always conform to meaning. Most of the time it does. I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But anyway, so what we have here then is a verse with two different kinds of trup, which conveys two very different meanings. And that was the question that the Gemara had. Now, the Gemara speaks about there being trup, although there were two opinions, whether there were trup in the time of Ezra. I know with absolute certainty two things. I know that there was trup by the time of the Gemara. And I also know, though, that the trup itself was not rigid and fixed as much, perhaps, as the way we have it now. I know that because there's a Gemara in Yoma, this is source number 9, that says, Isi ben Yehuda Omer, Chamesh Mikraos Batorah, Ein Lohem Hechreya. There are five words in the Torah where it's not clear where the punctuation goes. And they quote the five words. I will tell you that four of them, the pshat, I think, is clear. But I only want to mention one because it genuinely could be seen as ambiguous. And that is the word mishukadim. It refers to a pasuk in my bar mitzvah parsha. Uvaminora arba'ogivim mishukadim kaftorei afracheha. There were three kinds of decorations in the menorah in the Mishkan. There were gvim, they translate them as goblets. There was the shape or something like that. There were kaftorim and prachim. Prachim are flowers. Kaftorim, maybe, I don't know, were some kinds of round balls or something like that. So the verse reads, Uvamenora arba'o gvim mishukadim kaftorei afracheha. There are two ways to read that verse. Uvamenora arba'o gvim, comma, and mishukadim kaftorei afracheha. The kaftorim and the prachim were mishukadim. They were decorated with almonds or something. The other way to read it is Uvam Nora Arba Givim Meshukadim, Kama, Kaftarao Fracheha, maybe we're also Meshukadim. That's what the Gemara is not sure about. Now here's the interesting question. I know what the trump on that pasuk is. I'll read it for you. Uvam Nora Arba Givim Meshukadim Kaftarao Fracheha. It's clear where the Esnachta is. So the question I ask is, why didn't Isi Ben Yehuda just look at where the Esnachta is? So that at least implies to me that there's some degree of things are not quite rigid. Today, you wouldn't ask the question. You'd look in your Tanakh and the earliest Tanakhs that we have, you know, with trup, and it's very clear where they go. Okay. So anyway, so that is as far as the earlier stages. Where do our trup come from? So there, I've referred to once by accident, and once on purpose, the people known as the Bale Masora. In a nutshell, this is not the place for it. Until the 5th century, 6th century, our Sifrei Tanakh basically looked like a Sefer Torah. All they had in them were letters and spaces, sometimes bigger spaces for parshias, and that's it. If you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see Torah scrolls or Tanakh scrolls that would have looked the same even 6 centuries later. Came along these people called the Bale Masora. I'm oversimplifying. For our purposes, the Bale Masora we know lived in Tiberias, and they did their work probably between the 6th and the 10th centuries. They were the ones who took our consonantal text. They created a vowel system, a written vowel system, so you would know how to pronounce the words. They didn't invent the pronunciation. They had a received tradition of how the words were pronounced, but they invented the symbols for our vowels. They invented the symbols for music, our trup, and they laid it down for us. And they did some other very important things to make sure that the text was preserved very carefully in its transmission to prevent errors from happening. So the Bali Masora were the ones who basically gave us our trup and on the words. And for the most part, at this point, our trup is relatively uniform across different printings and different texts. But obviously, when the Bali Masora presented it, so it represented their interpretation of the text. I don't mean necessarily their own, but their received interpretation of the text. And so I'm going to look at a couple of them. But what I do want to say before I go there is that punctuation, the trup provides punctuation, but it's not always accurate. The reason for that is because sometimes the way verses are constructed, it doesn't lend itself readily to the system of trup that we have. The system of trup that we have on Torah specializes in breaking things down into two. We'll see eventually the Ta'ame MS do a little better breaking things down into three when necessary, but Torah trup can be fairly constrained because it only naturally breaks units down into two and then further units, subunits into two. That's its most natural breakup. So between that and the fact that word order can sometimes be funny, it doesn't always work so easily. So we're going to look at some examples over the course of the coming weeks to explore when it doesn't really fit. And again, that's before you get to interpretation, before you get to midrashim that might be incorporated and things like that. The system of trup isn't perfect for sometimes for capturing the meaning and punctuation. But so that is a limitation. There also may be musical reasons for certain things, why certain decisions are made. They don't always conform perfectly to punctuation. But with that caveat, for the most part, the trup provides a pretty good guide to punctuation. And that's mostly what we're going to be looking at. One notable example where you can see funny things go on with the trup is the Tam HaElyon and the Tam HaTachton in the Ten Commandments, in the Aseres HaDibros. There are two sets of trup there. In many printings, they print them at the same time. Woe to the inexperienced Bal Koreh who's got to figure out what's going on there. Which trup? Because the word has two trups on it. But those are very unusual verses. Some very unusual things happen because there's a different agenda there. The agenda there is to have each commandment be one verse, which means Shabbos, and Anochi are enormous. They're giant, or Eloia are enormous because those are very long commandments. On the other hand, you have very short commandments like Lo Tirzach and Lo Tinaf and so on and so forth. But on the whole, the punctuation generally conforms. So the trup conforms to the punctuation. So I wanted to take really, I guess we have time for two, maybe, I don't know if I have time for a third example, of very, very famous examples of this. Where trup can be used for meaning, and in some case it reflects very specific traditions that we have. My favorite one, and I think it's a famous one, is a verse that we read every year in Chutzla, or it's twice in Israel once. Say ulamad ma bikesh lavan arami lasos sheparo lo gazar al zcharim v'lavan arami bikesh lakor es hakol. Now, and then we say shenemar, and we quote the pasuk of Arami oved avi. Now, Arami Oved Avi is a very, well, so how does the Baal HaHagadah understand it? And this is reflected in the Medrash Halacha, source number 11, the Medrash Tana in Ledvarim, and it's reflected in Targum Unkelis and then in Rashi, but Rashi's obviously later. These are two, the Medrash Tanaim and Unkelis, I don't know if they're earlier than the Baal HaHagadah, but they're very early. They all reflect the idea that Arami refers to Lavan Arami, and Oved means that he tried to destroy Avi, my father, Yaakov. So the way the Targum translates source number 12, Lavan Arama'a Be'a wanted to La'abada Yos'aba. He wanted to destroy my father. And that's how the Baal HaGadah read it. That's how Rashi reads it. There's one significant problem with this interpretation. The problem is that the word Oved in biblical Hebrew, in the binyan, the conjugation in which it's in, is what we call intransitive, what the Rishonim call poel eno yotze. It doesn't take a direct object. If you wanted to say that Lavan tried to destroy my father, you should have said Lavan ibeid es abba in the PL, or evid es abba in the hifil. Oved is intransitive. It doesn't act on something else. And as Ibn Ezra and Rashbam point out, Oved means lost or wandering or straying. Ibn Ezra claims poor. We say a se'oved, a wandering sheep, a lost sheep. So the problem is, so what do you do with that? So I'm not here to answer that question. However, what is the pshat in the pasuk? What's the simple meaning? The simple meaning, Ibn Ezra and Rashbam both say, although each one identifies a different figure. Rashbam says, I think Arami was Avram Avinu, and Arami Oved Avi, a wandering Aramean was my father. And Ibn Ezra says it was Yaakov. Okay, either way, it means to say he was impoverished, he was lost. Now, the difference between these two interpretations is an eats, shoots, and leaves problem, which is where do you put the comma? The way the Baal HaHaggadah read it is Arami Oved Avi, Arami comma, and Aramean Oved Avi tried to destroy my father, subject and predicate. But if you want to read like Ibn Ezra and Rashbam, so then you read Arami Oved Avi, my father is the subject and Arami Oved is the predicate. My father was a wandering Aramean. Now, what does the trup reflect? So there were two options here. The correct trup, being the way the Bali Masora placed it for us, is in the pasuk itself. Arami Oved Avi, because the trup on Arami is a pause trup, and Oved Avi are connected with their trup. If that reflects the way we read Kriyas HaTorah, and if someone misread it, I would correct them, because the authorized interpretation is that of the Bali Masora. The alternative would be to read what I placed just below that, Arami Oved Avi. You would put the Pashta on the Oved. So here, with a very simple trop, which lousy Balei Kriya very often mess this kind of thing up, they're not well prepared, but by shifting the position of that Pashta trop, the one that's on Arami in the Pasuk, and in my version on Oved, that simply shifts where the comma is. And that reflects two very different interpretations of scripture. I'll just do one more example, and then I'll allow time for questions. It's an interesting situation of what was the birth order of Noah's three children. Now we know at the end of Parshas Bereishis, source number 17, the Torah tells us, Vayihi Noach ben Chamesh Me'o Shana. Noach was 500 years old. Vayolad Noach es Shem es Chom ves Yafes. Now, normally, when I introduce, you know, my children, and I say, this is Avram, and this is Yitzchak, and this is Yaakov, you assume Avram's the oldest, Yitzchak is the middle child, and Yaakov is the youngest child. That's what you normally would assume. So we're tempted to assume that Shem is the oldest, Chom is the middle child, and boy, did he have middle child syndrome, and Yafes would be the youngest. However, that's not so simple, because after Chum does what he does, the Torah tells us the following in source 18, the second verse, Vayiketz Noach Mieno, Noach woke up from his drunken stupor, Vayeda Isa Sharasalo Benoach Katan, and he realized what his youngest son had done to him. Now his youngest, the son who had done whatever he did, was Chum. Now, to make things a little more interesting, Eila told those Shem, source 19. These are the genealogies of Shem. Shem ben Ma'ashana. Shem was 100 years old. Vayolad es Ha'Parshad. When he gave birth to Ha'Parshad, Shnasayim achar Ha'Mabul. That means that Shem was 100 years old 2 years after the Mabul. How old was Noach 2 years after the Mabul? 602. But Noach gave birth to his first child at 500. So Shem could not have been his oldest child. There was at least one son born before Shem. And then the last piece to the puzzle is a verse earlier in Parshas Noach, source number 20. Ulashem yulad gamhu, aviko b'nei ever, achi yefes hagadol. Shem is the last of the children to have his genealogies listed. So you have Chum, then you have Yefes, you have Yefes, then you have Chum, and then you have Shem. And the Torah says that Shem also had children. He and Shem was the father of all b'nei ever, Achi Yefes HaGadol, the brother of Yefes, the elder. So there's an ambiguity here, as Rashi points out immediately. Eini Yodan, source 21, Im Yefes HaGadol, Im Shem. I don't know who's older, Yefes or Shem. And what Rashi basically reasons is, if Chum is the youngest, and Shem or Yefes has to be the oldest, based upon when Shem was born, when Noach was 502, it must be that Yefes is the older. But what Rashi is asking here fundamentally is a comma question. If you want to say that Shem is Achi Yefes HaGadol, is it Shem? Is Achi Yefes Kama HaGadol, meaning he is the older brother of Yefes? Or is Shem Achi, the brother of Kama, Yefes HaGadol, the oldest one? What's particularly interesting to me here is that Rashi did not appeal to the trup to solve his problem. It happens to be that the trup is the same as Rashi's interpretation, because the way it's read is Achi Yefes HaGadol, it's Tipcha, which is a major pause, followed by Yefes HaGadol, which go together. If in fact Shem were the older one, then the Pasuk would have read the way that one of the most common mistake amongst Balei Kriya who aren't careful, it would have read Achi Yefes HaGadol. It's probably the most common error Balei Kriya is to reverse Amercha Tipcha, and it's a big no-no. But here, it literally changes the interpretation 180 degrees. Who is the oldest sibling? And yet Rashi didn't appeal to the trup, but it happens to be that the trup reflects a particular interpretation. There are many, 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 many examples of this. I gave one more. I'm not going to go through it now, but you can watch. If you look in Source 24, Rashbam attacks a certain interpretation and says that anybody who interprets that way knows nothing about how psukim are breaking up and how trup work. Incidentally, he was talking about his grandfather Rashi. I could defend Rashi, but anyway, you can read that on your own. But this really is in a broad nutshell, in a broad overview, really is the function of trup. This last part, which is to provide the punctuation. So what we've seen tonight really is that trup has three functions. It has a musical function, which we're not going to discuss at all. It has a function of telling you, in most cases, where the accent is, which can have an impact upon meaning, and that we discussed a little bit. And then the third most significant part of Ta'amei HaMikra, of the trup, is to provide commas of various levels so one knows how to parse the verse, and therefore one understands actually what the verse may mean. So in many cases, it doesn't always impact the meaning, because sometimes there's only one possible meaning, but there are a lot of cases where changing the trup or where how the trup got placed can actually choose between two different meanings. In effect, Tamei HaMikra are an interpretation. Okay, I'll stop the formal presentation here. I'm happy to take questions for a few minutes.
Thank you. You want to take a look on the side?
I can do that.
Or I can feed you the couple comments.
I just want to know, are all these questions or just comments to other people?
Both. You have to go through them. Well, I can do that for you a little bit.
Okay. May I ask a question while you're doing that?
Go ahead.
Vayishlach Avraham et yado vayikachat macheles lishchod es beno. The Torah actually learns halacha from this. It's not a misplaced esnachta. There was a pause. Where would you put the esnachta otherwise? I disagree quite a lot with your premise. The trop always informs the meaning and the punctuation.
I think that we will see examples where there is no way to tell me that the trop is informing the meaning. There are many, many wonderful examples. One could argue that Vayishlach Avraham es yado, and that the pshat should have been Vayishlach Avraham es yado, kama esnachta, Vayikach es machalos lishchot es beno. And you can, or I could think of, I don't know what the Torah says, I could think of interpretation.
We'll discuss it next time if you're interested. The 12 sides, the 12 sides that the Sakan must be Nivdak.
Okay, all I would say is that. All I would say is that without forgetting about the halacha.
Doesn't mention the trap.
For dramatic purposes, I could see why that would be done. I'll leave it at that. Okay.
Okay, somebody wanted to know, are the klishas meant to be sung differently? You put them, they have to do it. And why in the world would they have it just as a circle? Why didn't they create it differently?
So this is what's very interesting about this. The tlishas, the way I was taught them, they're very similar, but I can distinguish them, which is tlisha ketano, tlisha gedolo. Now, what's strange about the music being similar is that the tlisha gedola is a pause trap. It's what we call a mafsik. A tlisha ketana is what's called a mishares. It serves the next word. Now, I have heard, and I heard this once from a kid laying bar mitzvah in my shul, and I think it comes from some conservative cantor, a tradition of reading a Tlisha Gedola much closer to a Pazer. The way he read it was, Tlisha Gedola. Now, I'll tell you why it's right, and I'll tell you why it's wrong. It always made sense to me because it's a pause trop, like a Pazer. Not only that, but it happens to be a Tlisha Gedola is a substitute for a Pazer. When you can't use a Pazer based upon number of words, a Tlisha Gedola is the substitution. In that way, it makes sense. But at the same time, Reb Breuer points out, the fact that they use the same symbol for both suggests that the music was probably very similar, which would be a defense of the tradition that I learned to read the two. So you can make an argument both ways, whether the music should be similar or not. There are two different traditions, if you might want to put it, two different ways it's done. And you could go either way on it. But the most important thing that I think is clear is that a Tlisha Gedola, no, but not disputed. Tlisha Gedola is a pause trop. A Tlisha Katana is attached to the next word.
For my knowing the difference between Tlisha Katana and Tlisha Gedola, to me, it seemed that the Tlisha Katana was longer because it went down at the end, whereas the Tlisha Gedola seemed to stay there. So I said, this doesn't make sense.
So I know, but I think you could sort of see a little bit. Again, the way this young man did it, was taught to do it, really stood out. It stood out. He happened to be a bar mitzvah parsha was Pinchas. So you have at the end, Minchas amaniskehem laporim. And you had a series every day was like that. So like, if you missed the first one, by the next six, you realize like, what's going on here? But I think even the difference isn't obvious enough to explain one is a pause or not. If you know that one is a pause and one is not, then you can sort of tell yourself, one really leads into the next one, one not, but I'm not sure. Okay.
Why couldn't you put a pazer where you put a klisha? You said the klisha is...
Pazer requires a certain... Hopefully over the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about it. But pazer requires a certain number of words. Theoretically, you can have two pazers in a row, but if you don't have enough words, one of them gets changed to a Tlisha Gedola.
Okay. Somebody's asking, I have to think what this is. In Parshat Vayigash, I also have Haba'a twice, Mil El Ra.
I don't want to go into that. The problem there is that the meaning actually doesn't conform to the way the trop is done. That's a discussion for Biblical Hebrew, not a discussion for us. Different class, a different course, but I'm aware some of those don't actually, there are issues with some of those. I'm just going to leave it at that. Let's put it this way. For those whoever asked the question, there's a very big problem if the word is ba'a, putting a hey on it. A verb normally never has a hey in front of it. Only a noun or an adjective, which is what a hoveh is. And a past tense verb should not be able to get a hey in front of it. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I won't say anything more on it. That's a very complicated case.
Okay. I hope I understand this question of Baruch. The meaning of le'el, like milel before, technically means above, higher, is le'ela mikol berchata in Kaddish. But since earlier on the written and printed page is situated higher on the page, it is used to mean earlier too. Is that correct?
I don't, that sounds plausible to me. I don't know what the origin, why earlier in the word is higher and the other one is lower. I don't know. I just know that that's what those words mean in Aramaic. So,
okay, let's just see. Parsha Chukat, it is short, but it's the same trop issue as the Ten Commandments. I'm not sure what that's talking about in Parsha Chukat. I don't know what you're referring to.
I'm over here. There's a different shirim in the Torah. One of them is the Aseret HaDibrot, one of them Shirat Hayam, one of them is in Chukat, and sometimes the trope switched. I don't remember where exactly, but I remember that my teacher told me there was a thing. I don't remember exactly where. I'll find it for you for next time.
Okay.
Yisrael et Ashira Zos, Aliba Enula. That's what you're referring
to. Thank you.
Yes.
I know there's Shiras HaBe'er in Chukas. I don't know what the question is.
What's the question?
Wasn't there a trope differentiation where the symbols didn't match?
I'm not sure.
So why didn't my Rav tell me that?
I'm still not sure. I don't know. I'm wondering if something got lost in translation.
Maybe you're referring to the minhag of Az Yashir of singing it a little differently in terms of the tune?
I think so.
I mean, I think the question of why we don't sing it differently, so we don't, it happens to be the Shiras Hayam is the only one of the Shiros that we sing differently. Some people, I do at least the travels in Maaseh a little differently. Some people do them Halosa differently, but it's the only Shira. I don't know. I mean, I know what the pattern is. It's usually when God's name appears is when we do the special tune. Actually, now that you're saying that, I believe actually that's probably why. That's probably taught you. There's no, I think Rashi quotes, that God's name doesn't appear, I think, in the Shiras HaBe'er, because Moshe's name doesn't appear, something like that, because Moshe was smitten by the bear. So that's why you wouldn't do any special music. But Hazinu has God's name, and we also don't do special music. So I don't know what the origin how far back doing the Shiras HaYam differently comes. But
thank you for the clarification. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for the person who figured out the question.
Okay, Ruth just wants to know about Karnei Para. I think there's a little bit
Karnei Para. We can talk about that next week. A Karnei Para is, if you actually look in the earlier printings, it's not called the Karnei Para. It's called the Pazer Gadol.
Right.
I'll speak personally, and I'm not going to say right or wrong. When my younger years laning, I used to read it as two tlishas. And then when Professor Moshe Bernstein pointed out to me that some call it a Pazer Gadol, it makes sense that a Pazer is one, Pazer, and a Shalshelis is three. So a Pazer Gadol, you do two. I don't know what the music really has to be, but I'll tell you the following. A Karnei Para is another form of a Pazer. And it's a mafsik just like a Pazer. I don't know if we even know why we get it. And the other special thing about the Karnei Para is it has a unique servant trap, a unique mishares, namely the Yerach Ben Yomo. You only get a Yerach Ben Yomo right before Karnei Para. Every Karnei Para has a Yerach Ben Yomo right before it. I think they're like,
there's
10 in Tanakh, 14. I have the number somewhere.
There's only one in the Chumash, 15. Correct?
Only one, there are only one two in our liturgy, at least Ashkenaz and what we read, and probably anyone else. One in the Torah in Parshas Maaseh, in Perek Lamed, right. And one in Megillas Esther. In
15 all, 15 altogether. 15.
Okay, 15.
Okay, the expert Bali Kriya here. It's nice to see. Okay, any other questions? Anybody want to ask a question? I think that's pretty much it from the on the chat box. If anyone has a question, please ask. In the meantime, I want to thank you very much.